I'm Roel Tweet, and afternoons I fly airplanes and as therapy. English teachers need that. And evenings and mornings, this week at least, I'm going to explore some of the difficulties with the English language, and I want to start out tonight by talking about some of the difficulties of teaching it and learning it. I understand there are some ex-English teachers, present English teachers, and future English teachers, here. And so I, before I say anything, I would like to tell you that I think English is a worthwhile profession. And it isn't as bad as I'm going to make it sound. It sometimes is worse. But in spite of it all, I think it's worth it. Anybody familiar with education, if you have kids in school or grandchildren in school, or if you are a part of the school system, are aware of the so-called deplorable state of writing. Most of you who have kids are aware that they do not write as well as they ought to. You're probably aware of the facts and figures. We are the only country in the world, as far as I know at least, that has to teach its own language at the college level. There is no freshman German, or even freshman English in England, or freshman French. But there is, and there's a need for, in our school systems, freshman English at the college level. And that, to many people, suggests that somewhere, something has gone wrong with the system. The one course that students complain about at Augustana, where I teach, the one course they complain about, except for the occasional goody-goody, back in high school, is English. And specifically by English, they mean writing. By and large, they hated it and didn't learn it very well. Supposedly, I happen to think that they're learning it better than they ever have learned it, but I'll get into that later. Nevertheless, the statistics seem to indicate that writing ability is going down. The college boards, since 1971, have dropped in verbal ability, the average score in the United States, 40 points. And there was a disastrous two-year period, I think in 75-76, where they dropped 10 points a year. So that seems to indicate to many people that writing ability on the part of our students coming into the system now is deteriorating, and deteriorating very, very rapidly. Part of the big back-to-basics movement that I'll talk about a little bit, you are probably aware of too, if you have any interest at all in your local school systems. Recently, a new phrase has been coined, teacher burnout, and it's not just a phrase. Many of the English teachers in high school that I know are thinking of getting out, have gotten out, or are in dire need of taking a leave of absence and getting away from it. If people who are fortunate, like me, can fly model airplanes and they work. Teaching English doesn't always work, and there's some advantage to doing something occasionally that works. But our own situation at the college level is no different, I suspect, than it is at the high school level. I've taught at Augustana for 20 years. We have changed freshman English texts in a vain attempt to get the perfect course, I think 17 times. Each spring, when we come time to choose the new text, we say, there's got to be a better way of doing it. We find the perfect text. This is going to wow the students. This is really going to teach them English. By October of every year, we know it isn't going to work. Bombed out again. And so we pick another one of the 200 or 300, literally, different texts available in an attempt to try to plug in to what students might conceivably be interested in writing. And the results never seem to show at all. Statistics that have been done, surveys that have been done, University of Iowa, Iowa State and Ames, for instance, a few years ago, decided to really test whether freshman English had any effect on students at all. And so they took half the freshman class as a control group, made them take the requisite freshman English, took the other half of the class, dismissed them entirely from any writing requirements, and then tested and monitored this class all the way through to the senior level. And were unable to detect any difference it made in the writing ability, in their grades, in their interests, in what they majored in. Absolutely unable to detect any influence that freshman English course at the college level had. So it's not just high school I'm talking about, it's really the whole system. If you really want to be glad you're not an English teacher, try this next time. And anybody here who is in English at any level, I'm sure, has had the same experience. The next time you're riding on an airplane or a bus or just at a party someplace and some stranger comes up to you, and one of the first things an American wants to know is, what do you do? Because somehow that defines us. Try saying you're an English teacher. What do you think the response is? Always, the response is always some embarrassed comment about, well, I can't spell banana. Or, I just never get complete sentences. And then they turn away and they look out the window and count clouds or telephone poles or whatever. And I don't think it's just me. I think that somehow there is this kind of negative antagonism toward an English teacher. I suspect that if I had said, for instance, on the other hand, I'm an astronomer, the person would want to know, how can you tell how far apart the stars are? What are the stars? Do you think there's life on Mars? Full of questions. Or even physics. Or a doctor or a lawyer. Nobody ever says, oh, I haven't been as good as I should be lately, if you say you're a lawyer and look out the window. They do this to English teachers. Why do you, let me hear that from some of you, why that response? We hear that somebody is even majoring in English or married to an English teacher.
They think they should know and embarrass the
teacher. Well, you talk and write every day. It's kind of, you know, you don't always gaze at stars.
But why does it bother them?
Is that a negative experience?
What kind of a negative experience? I had plenty of negative experiences in chemistry.
Maybe they didn't get good grades in it. Maybe it was a problem that they had filling out application forms.
Okay, it could be a lot of things. Let me suggest something that I think it is. Let me give you an exam. Suppose you walk into a grocery store and say to the clerk, I would like 3 pounds of bananas. And he says, I'm sorry, ma'am, I haven't got no bananas. Now, is that okay or not?
No, you'd ask for oranges.
Why? Okay. Is that a correct response or not?
No.
Why not?
Is it correct or not?
What makes it incorrect? Yeah, so what? Okay, why ain't it right? It certainly does. Would you ever say, especially if he was bigger than you, fine, I'll have 4 pounds? You know what the person meant, didn't you?
Yes,
it's the way that the most prestigious group of our society speaks, and therefore we tend to categorize ourselves by our levels of speech.
Okay,
the way our radio announcers
that's speak. What's wrong with it, is that it is socially unacceptable to the upper crust or to the middle class. It is not that it is ununderstandable. You perfectly well understand somebody who says, I haven't got no. You don't understand that two negatives make a positive, and reply by saying, I'll have 4 pounds of bananas. You know exactly what he meant, and in fact, you know that he used it for double emphasis. It means he really doesn't have no bananas, period.
That's cute.
Furthermore, Shakespeare used it, and Chaucer used it. And what's good enough for them ought to be good enough for us. When the English teacher marks that wrong, then, he is really not correcting your language or your clarity. He is correcting your social level. And I think one of the big resentments, that same thing is true with ain't. There is no word that can take the place of ain't. It's difficult to say am'n't, I am'n't going, and that's why ain't came in. And so there's a very, very good use for the word ain't. But again, when somebody says ain't, all of us do it informally, and the dictionary now accepts it as informal usage. But when you use it, you know what the person meant. Therefore, it does communicate. But what you also know is that he's a little bit beneath you because he uses socially unacceptable language. The difficulty, it seems to me, with English teachers that you don't run into with physics or astronomy or Phi Ed coaches or whatever else, of all the people I've had miserable experiences with, you single out the English teacher as the policeman for society. So not only is he teaching correct writing, but he's teaching socially acceptable behavior of a certain particular class. And I think that's the embarrassment. The embarrassment isn't that you can't speak well. You all speak fairly well informally, and some of you speak very well publicly and write very well. The embarrassment comes because there is this added dimension to what the English teacher is doing that is a social dimension. It is the English teacher that is teaching you manners as well as just speech. And I'll get back to that a little bit later. But at any rate, then, I think that's what is frustrating for English teachers, is that we're no longer so sure that it really is our function to be a policeman. Let me give you an example. A student comes in to me. We get several students because of where Augustana is each year from the inner city of Chicago who are black and who speak black English. That means, among other things, that instead of saying I am or I will or I have been, they use be. I be going, which can mean I will be going, or I am in the process of going, or I have gone. Black English has its own rules. It has, and they speak black English perfectly and correctly. Now, they come into my English class, and on a theme, they write, I be going to town last week. What should I put on their paper? Do they have a right to speak their language in the same way that I, middle class, white, have a right to speak my language? Is it my function as an English teacher to take that perfectly good, colorful, even more dramatic, richer in many ways, black English, and say, you can't do that around here. Here you've got to speak the way the socially acceptable crust speak. Until 10 or 15 years ago, we had no question but that is exactly what we were supposed to do as English teachers. And I guess today, if I let that student go, if I give him A's for writing powerful, dramatic black English, which I feel inclined to do, and he slips through my class, and that's the only confrontation he has with an English teacher, he will go out and graduate and go to John Deere, which is where everybody tries to get jobs first in our area. And he will say to the personnel manager, I be graduated from Augustana, and they won't hire him. So I am in a real dilemma as to whether it is my function to twist that kid out of his language, which he has a right to, into mine to make him socially... Am I a policeman of society? Or should I be, if you heard Larry this morning, should I preach liberation writing? I mean, should I, why, at what point, where is my obligation to the system or to that student who has his own sense of worth and being too? Yeah.
I think you really have two obligations to that student. One is to encourage him to be creative in his own language. Another is to teach him a second language, which he can use when he chooses to fit into middle-class American.
Except that he doesn't have that choice.
But I think that in many cases that's why they come to. I know out east an experiment was done where the school system decided not to impose the standard acceptable form of English upon minority students who had already been learning black English in the home. And the parents of these minority students were upset, and they were instrumental in having that practice change, because they felt that not to teach their children standard English and give them this tool was to keep them out of middle class jobs and professions.
And that's exactly the fine. But nevertheless, the minute I say to that student, that's fine, you can speak that to me, but you know, we know that isn't going to go on the outside. No, I suppose what I end up doing is this kind of bilingual thing, but I feel very uneasy with it. And I think English teachers who are really concerned about the person as well as about society, who are not totally rebel and not totally policemen, are really caught in a very, very odd kind of bind today.
That's something else too. You're not just correcting someone's language or teaching them a new language. Most people perceive their language as being the most personal thing they've got. And when they feel that someone disapproves of it, they feel that you disapprove of me. You're not just disapproving of
the words I use. Look through any freshman English text, and you will find this didn't strike me until this last May, literally. And I've taught English for 20 years. In the end of each of the books, look through your kids' books if you want to know why they hate English. And in the end, there are a list of 300 marks, sometimes 200, 100, 50 basic marks, punctuation, awkward, transition, and so forth. There are 300 marks, let's say, for things that are wrong. There is not a single mark in the end of that book for anything right. Policeman. There's not a single mark for anything right. To make a nice comment, I can't write a squiggle. A squiggle always means you goofed. You didn't do things right. And I agree with you. To some extent, you're not a real person. Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is the red pen. It looks like someone's taken blood and gone through it.
I started out red pen, then I went to blue pen, and pencil finally, because pencil is sort of soft and gentle.
Right.
I'm back to red again. Because that's just a cover-up, too. The minute you make a mark on that page, you take it personally. Mm-hmm. My mother was an English teacher of a very old-fashioned kind, and although she's retired 10 years, she still is. And when I was away at college and started writing home, I would get my letters back correctly. And the end result is, I mean, she was dyed in the wool English teacher. The end result is I don't write very much anymore. And I don't know whether she's aware of that or not, but I think that's a real problem.
Well, I think there's a whole dilemma in language standardization, in standard language, and when we consider that language, our language has evolved and grown, and that language continues to evolve and grow, and that only happens when things are done in a non-standard manner, when things are done in a manner that is socially unacceptable or that is against the rules of English.
The minute you say the rules of English, even those tend to change, because the double negative was once perfectly acceptable. Now, should I personally think the double negative is a good, nice, strong kind of phrase.
And I can think of phrases or ways of using language or words which are so common, but which are, I think, still, according to the rules, considered not right. Like, my mom always says, your bread raises. And I always correct her and say, no, it doesn't raise, it rises. But so many people...
Why do you correct her?
Because I was taught that raise is an intransitive verb. I mean, that raise is transitive and rise is intransitive. And...
Okay, let me give you another, since you know the rules of grammar. It's I or it's me.
It depends on what follows. If you're saying, it is I who does something. Or you could say, it is me to whom he was talking, or something weird like that.
No, it should be. Should be what?
I.
Why should it be I?
Should be nominative case pronoun.
Okay. The grammatical, if you take an exam, if you take a college board score, here's the problem. If you still are going to have to answer, it is I. The freshman English text we're using this year, however, says it's me is correct, and it's I in most situations is wrong. Now, why? Because usage is what determines what people speak, and usage is constantly changing. Nobody sits down and makes up rules of grammar. They simply describe the way the situation is. The example I use with my students is, imagine a girl being called to the phone by a telephone call from a guy, and he says, hello, Sue, and she says, it is I. Now, in that particular situation, is I correct? Absolutely not, unless she doesn't want a date. In that situation,
In that situation, socially, what she should say is, hi, it's me. Even if she's majoring in English and is going to teach English, she ought to say me. Because there, me indicates a kind of informality that, I just doesn't communicate. All of us say it's me. Very seldom will you hear anybody say it is I, except wrongly when they're trying to impress an English teacher. And it's used wrongly more often than it's used correctly today.
And the usage, too, determines whether the meaning is understood. And when you talked about the double negative, and I said, well, because it doesn't say what the person intended to say, and you said, yes, it does say that. And then I thought, well, yes, it does say that, because people understand it to mean that. And I can think of another example, where people always say something is different than something else, whereas I was taught that you're supposed to say different from. But you hear, like on national TV, you hear the weatherman say,
okay,
today will be
a very good example of a fight that is almost lost by English teachers who are purists. For 10 years, I corrected different. There is no different than indicates degree. It's got to be different from, logically. But everybody uses different than.
And I was in a class where my professor was, he knew perfectly well what the student meant when the student said different than. And he must have spent 5-10 minutes arguing with that student or pretending like he didn't understand what the student meant because the student had said different than. And everybody was so irked because everybody knew that the professor, well, everybody that knew the rule of grammar anyway, knew that the professor meant, knew what the student meant.
Okay, let me just give you a little history of how composition teaching has done a kind of flip-flop, and then I'd like to really ask how many of you think, particularly those of you who are not teachers of English. I'm going to read an example of exactly what some of you have been saying from a textbook that is fairly recent. We really didn't have this problem for a long time as English teachers or as teachers of language, because I think we assumed, along with the Greeks, that is nearly all of Western civilization, that a person became human only by a kind of nurture, by being taken over by parents and peers and institutions of the state and molded into a human being. The Greeks had no hesitation in leaving an infant they didn't want out on the hillside to die as a way of getting rid of it until it had suckled. And at that point, it began the process of becoming not just an animal with the potential of being human, but it began the process of civilization. And the Greek state, the parents, the Greek religion then took this child and nurtured him, directed him, patterned him, and turned him from what would have been merely a beast into a civilized human being. And so the Greeks then called people who didn't have the benefit of Greek civilization barbarians. That's all they were. They were not real people. They were not human. Human is something that happens to you that is molded and patterned and shaped into you. And I think most of us have grown up in an educational system that agrees that the way to become educated, the way to become civilized, is to be told to do this, do this, do this, do this, until eventually it becomes sort of second nature to you. The Greeks taught writing, first of all, by just having the student copy great works of literature. And as the hand patterned and as the mind went over these, well, it didn't make any difference if it was original or not. But as the hand began to write this and as the mind began to think these thoughts, it was patterned in much the same way that sometimes brain-damaged children can be helped by being patterned through crawling and through the various stages of coherence. Then they began, the second step, much later, was imitation. You took great models of literature and imitated their style, imitated their way of thinking. And only at the very end of the process, when one was finally thoroughly civilized, were you allowed to do your own work, expected to do your own work. But by then, your work looked like the work of people who had gone before because you had been patterned and civilized. Most of us can recall, if you're over 40 at least, the old confirmation class, which I apparently for good or ill is gone for good, in which you memorized. I can still quote long passages. I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength, et cetera, et cetera. I have the slightest, and I never did, what they meant. But I memorized them, and I memorized, and I memorized. My son has just gone through confirmation. I don't think they had a thing to memorize at all. So there's a big shift that has taken place. At any rate, then, the assumption was that a human, in order to become civilized, needed to be programmed, needed to be taught that this is correct, and that this is the way we do things, and that a society had the right and the duty, in fact, to decide, maybe arbitrarily, but nevertheless decide, that this is the way we are going to say this sentence. The double negative is going to be out. It went out in the 18th century in English when science came in, and because in math two negatives make a positive, lo and behold, they did in English too. So for an absolutely stupid and silly and arbitrary and wrong reason, the double negative went out. But it's out, and it's not ours to question. The same thing is true, I think, with the way we used to teach literature. Everybody in the United States, again, if you're over 40, probably has read Macbeth and Silas Marner and blah, 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 and so forth, so that you could go from Maine to Oregon to New Mexico, and everybody read the same thing. Because somebody decided, the school system, that in order to turn out an educated young lady or gentleman to separate them from the masses, this is what an educated person ought to know. And Silas Marner happened to be one of those. Silas Marner is a very good book, but it's a very bad book, I think, to give high school juniors or sophomores, unless they're very unusual. Silas Marner, 1958, was voted by high school seniors graduating around the country the worst book, the most hated book in the world. And that's what we have done as English teachers to Silas Marner, as policemen for society, for a particular segment of society. Then, beginning in 1930, and some of you can see bits and pieces of this educational system coming in to you. I don't think it's strictly chronological, but beginning in 1930, John Dewey began to have a big influence in the United States with his emphasis on learning by doing. And gradually, this old traditional body of literature and way of writing as an elitist kind of thing, you learn to write in a way that separated yourself from other people, who didn't have as good an education as you had or who were illiterate, we began to get communications courses. I suppose this was heightened by World War II, but by the time I entered the high school system in the late 1940s, just after World War II, I had courses not in literature, really, not in communication, not in writing per se, polished, professional, neat writing, but in practical things. I wrote memos and reports, letters of application, letters of condolence. We brought telephones into class and learned how to ask for dates, you know, hello, Alice. Oh, that's the night you wash your hair, sorry, you know, and so forth. We learned practical things. And that probably would have lasted for a lot longer than it did had 1958 not brought Sputnik, and with it a sudden realization that we were on the verge of losing out to the Russians. Look at the Russian students. They know five languages. They know this and they know that. And look at our students piddling around with telephones and asking for dates and stuff. Isn't that silly? And so almost overnight, we began a very, very heavy emphasis on academics. Students as early as sixth grade, literally, started doing research papers. I came across an eighth grade class that was doing King Lear and just pushing these students, we want to keep up with the Russians. And you wrote long-term papers, annotated bibliographies. This is what education is. Let's get with it. Let's get our students, really force them to do. There were courses in which you had to read 20 history books before you could even sign up for the history course the following fall as a senior or a junior. Honors courses and so forth and so on. In 1953, almost overnight, and I really don't have any way of explaining how or why this happened, except that it was the beginning of the civil rights movement, it was the beginning of the campus protest movement, it was the assassination of Kennedy, and maybe my students seem to think that that sort of triggered it. But all of a sudden, it's also the point at which new mass came in. All of a sudden, we began to emphasize as English teachers not so much communication, not so much the rigid social skills of not using a double negative and not using ink, but expression. We began to see that writing was
was very, very personal and very, very expressive. And we began to see, or think we saw, at least, because I'm not so sure that now that this is the case either, but we began to see that students were uptight about writing, not because they didn't have a talent within them, but because they were afraid of expressing themselves, but because the school system had taught them to give the teacher back what the teacher wanted. And instead of learning to communicate, most learning had been non-communication. What our culture does, we began to realize, or think we realize, what our culture does is to teach us to keep our mouths shut, to fill in the blanks, and tell it like the teacher wants. If the teacher wants big words, give the teacher big words. If the teacher wants it that way, give it that way. That's, I suppose, a natural process. If you ask a 5-year-old what you think the grandmother's hat, she'll tell you it's 20. Okay, if you ask a 9-year-old, he may not quite in so many words say it's funny, but still there's a little honesty left. By the time a girl is 13 or 14, she'll say, it's okay, Grandma. By the time she's 21, she'll say, it's just like you, Grandma, whatever that might mean. But isn't that a process not of learning to be open and honest and really communicate, but to not communicate? One of the assignments I try out on my students, just as a kind of joke, is to, the first day of freshman English, is to go up to a stranger that they of the opposite sex, just to make it a little interesting, and that they have never met before, but that they have admired something about. I love the way you answered in class or something like that, and compliment them. And 80% of them cannot do it. What do they think? Something might happen. They'll think I'm funny. And the answer probably is right. They would get those kind of responses. And then I say, wouldn't it be a better world if we could be more open like this? If we could go up to a stranger and say, I really like the clothes you're wearing, or admire them physically. I say, what can happen? It's only a compliment. I mean, the very least you're going to do is make somebody very happy. And then they say, well, can we say we're doing a critique class? No, that will blow it. I had a couple of students pursue this. The Augustana catalog, every college catalog has its beginning to justify the tuition. We're giving you not just an education, but we're teaching you to be a whole person, a real person, a full, rich, whatever it is, and so forth. And Augustana catalog has that too. And so these people then were going to, these two students, as one of their term paper assignments, secreted in a book a tape recorder, and they walked around the campus talking to freshmen and sophomores and juniors and seniors and faculty too. And one of the things Augustana is famous for is the Augustana smile. Students literally sign up to come to Augustana because after visiting the campus, everybody smiles and says hello. Hi, how are you? And we got to talking in class one day about how the opening, hi, how are you, must be responded to by what? Fine. You could be dying. You could be miserable. You must not answer anything but fine. In fact, you really ought not to go on beyond fine. You can answer back, how are you, and the other person has to say fine then too to continue the game. But here's a perfect example of where what pretends to be communication is not communication at all. It's a signal to cut off communication. If you really want to talk to the person, you're not going to say, hi, how are you? You're going to say something else. But and so they took this famous opening, hi, how are you, and what they responded, one of them, as they walked by, and they wanted to see whether freshmen were inferior to seniors who had led this, had gotten this rich Augustana education, and then the faculty who are teaching us rich education ought to be even better. And so they responded with a simple question, hi, how are you? I'm not very well. I've got to decide this morning whether to put my grandmother in an old people's home or not, and I don't know what to do. Not a person, faculty member, rich, glorious senior, lowly freshman, ever said anything, offered any opening. Nobody ever said, is there something I can do? Nobody ever said, you want to go to the union, have a cup of coffee and talk about it. I have a tape that has the most incredible responses on it. Well, gee, that's too bad. I got to go get my car fixed. As if the grandmother reminded him his own car was what was wrong and has to get fixed. And most of us in that same situation respond in exactly the same way. I think we would. Now, hopefully we wouldn't. But the students come to realize that it would be a better world, or they think they do at least, it would be a better world if we could be more open with each other. Now, this is what has happened since 1963 to the teaching of English. We've begun to say then that maybe what has happened is that English teachers are the ones responsible for the bad writing, for the lack of honest, open writing, for the lack of letting students say it the way they want to say it. And so for a period of time, really up until, I suppose, the mid-70s at least, and still continuing today, we are dealing with writing as self-expression. The purpose of an English teacher, the theory went, ought to be to enable you to become the real person. Now, this made a major assumption. The Greeks had assumed that the person is nothing before the society gets a hold of him and molds and shapes him. He wouldn't be anything left to himself. But the new assumption is that underneath all these rigid rules and so forth, there is a beautiful person just waiting to come out, waiting to be invited out. And the minute you put a red mark on the paper, the minute you stamp the paper, bad transition, the minute you say awkward sentence, you have pushed that student further into the shell. And that what we ought to do as English teachers is let that person out. And so we did all kinds of writing assignments, burning incense, and we get the pillows in class and sit on the floor and put a lemon in the middle, and then you look at the lemon and you write, I am a lemon, I am a... Pretty soon you're a lemon, and so forth. Here is a textbook that came out during the height of that period. It's called You. It has a metal cover. Can you guess why? Because when you look at it, you are there. Now, here are the writing assignments that come from You. Let me just... Here's a page, not your typical English text, but it may be for some of you who have taught this. It's a girl getting out of a bathtub. Here are some writing assignments that are designed, really, not to get you to think about nuclear warfare, but to let the real you come out, to let you be free of the policeman English teacher hovering over you, ready to mark bad things. Here are writing assignments from this text. Rub the back of the chair you are sitting on, and then rub your cheek. Describe the difference in how they feel and how your fingertips react to the different textures. Shut your eyes and have someone hand you something to feel, and you tell what it is. And here's a good one. Notice this text is on the side of the kids, anti-tearing. Describe the feel against your body of your own clothes, from shoes to shirt. What textures do you consider the most sensual? What textures make you feel safe? And then, how do your answers differ from those your parents would give? Now, this one I like, and I've been tempted to do it occasionally. Describe the sensation of lying naked in a bathtub of Jell-O. That's the real you. But the text I'd like to just read a passage from is a text written on old newsprint. It looks unlike a freshman text, it's supposed to. It's called It's Mine and I'll Write It That Way. And this text is designed for this new period of the teaching of English that I've just described. Let me read a passage and then open it. I guess I'm not going to have time to do a lot of discussion, but see what you think, whether you agree or disagree with that. Okay.
What's your thought on memorizing during the time that you have your confirmation compared to what your son is going through?
I remember I cannot by my own reason. Now, I don't remember much more than that, but that phrase is just glued right there.
And also...
I don't know. Larry said I would give answers at this session. I had answers 20 years ago. I really don't have any now. I'm on both sides of this question. I think most people who are intending to teach or who teach English are. I'm not in favor, per se, of memorization. But neither am I quite in favor of what I'm going to read now. of letting it all hang out. I'm not so sure that English teachers, maybe 5 years ago I thought that policemen were, being a policeman for society was the worst possible thing we could do. Maybe I'm just part of the Back to Basics movement. But here's the text, it's mine and I'll write it that way, and this expresses absolutely the opposite concept of the way in which most of us have learned English by memorization, by being shaped and molded and taught, this is correct, this is English. What our lives should be about, this is the note to the teacher at the beginning by the authors of the text, what our lives should be about is the creation of an atmosphere which makes it possible for a person to be himself. For it will be impossible for our students to express themselves until they are able to be themselves. And it will be reasonable for them to really be themselves while we stand over, it will be impossible for them to really be themselves while we stand over their shoulders with a red pencil, ready to mark failures in organization. As a matter of fact, if a student's mind does not work in an organized way, there is some reason to ask why his writing should be organized. If your mind works in a choppy way, a choppy style will express you much better than a smooth one. If your mind doesn't work in syllogisms, and whose does, you will express yourself better in prose devoid of syllogisms. The point is, my mother just horrified at this. The point is that what goes on to that sheet of paper, as somebody said earlier, exactly, what goes on to that sheet of paper that our students hand in for freshman English is him. At least if we are good, it will be. He doesn't hand in his writing, he hands in a part of himself. And it is time we started to treat it that way. It's time we all stop thinking of ourselves as policemen, not only because that creates a damaging distance between ourselves and our students, but because being a person isn't the same kind of being as driving to work without getting a ticket. It's different, or it should be. A writer should not be accompanied by a man from the license bureau who grades on how he signals, whether he goes too fast, and whether he makes certain stops. That's for driving, not rewriting. We are what we are, and if we write well, it is ourselves that we find and ourselves that we reveal on paper. And then finally, what does this mean? Giving a student a C for a paper is telling him he's a C person. It is arrogant, to say the least. Worse than that, it is destructive of what we are really trying to do as English teachers. And that leaves me in a kind of quandary. Do I give a student who obviously has written in something I cannot comprehend an F? It is true, isn't it? It is true for me that an F on a theme is, or any piece of writing, is much worse, it hurt me much more, than an F in a chemistry quiz. An F in a chemistry quiz really did mean I just didn't memorize that particular information or those particular formulas. But there is a way in which whatever I say on that piece of paper, every red mark, everything wrong, hits deeper to somebody's writing. And probably, if I give that student an F, he's going to go more into his shell. If he's a black student writing black English, and I put, we don't do that here, if you want a job in our world, you're going to have to say I am and not I be, that's not going to make him like me. It probably is not going to make him write I am. I don't know what it's going to do. On the other hand, if I let anybody say anything they want to say, because it's themselves, then the student is going to go into the next class or the next job or into life, and he isn't going to get very far. So I think one of the reasons that writing is difficult for English teachers to teach, and particularly difficult today for students to write, is that there are all sorts of theories floating around, and nobody is really sure which we ought to do, or how can I do a combination of treating the person as a human being with his own rights, and at the same time put red marks on the paper. I've got to give a grade. Or do I? Should I give everybody A's? I could, I suppose, and get away with it for a while. Okay, now. Yeah.
Well, when you were just posing your question to Sam, after you were saying something about what's legitimate and educated that people cannot comprehend. And to me, that's part of the answer. That's when considerations you've got to keep in mind. And as you kept talking, you got away from the idea of comprehension. that we're talking about self-expression and saying, why can't I write this way if it expresses myself? But you said, you've got a paper you can't comprehend. And what value is my self-expression if it doesn't express any, if it doesn't express that to somebody?
Communicate.
Yeah, if it doesn't communicate.
Okay, can I read a theme for you? I got this theme in 1971 at the height of the Vietnam War when students were genuinely concerned about writing. And I would like to ask you to grade this theme. The assignment was, I guess, comparison, contrast, that's theme five, and that's, you know, that precedes the argumentative theme and so forth. And we all build up the, we all have great focuses that do these things. A theme at Augustana is 600 words long, more or less. It goes really either way. And so forth and so on. Comparison contrast has certain forms. And if you want to write a good comparison contrast, there are rules to follow. Okay, I'm reading a group of papers and I get this theme. And I think I can remember it verbatim because it's the only theme from 1971 or 72 or 75 that I remember a sentence from. Here I sit, trying to write a silly assignment, getting a silly education. Meanwhile, outside, babies are being napalmed to death in Vietnam. People are starving to death. Whole cities are burning. So fuck this shit. Period. A, C, F, see me. Does somebody want to give it a grade?
A for communication.
What?
A for communication.
Is that fair to the other students who struggled through and got their 500 words? English teachers are responsible for a lot of bad writing because of the 500 word assignment. Football builds good sportsmanship. Got 494 words to go. In my opinion, football builds good sportsmanship. In my opinion, it is probably safe to say, and pretty soon you got 500 words saying football builds good sportsmanship. Buddy, A, you're giving it an A?
Well, no, I don't think you can give it one grade, but I think you can give it several grades for other reasons. Yeah. And then let them decide.
Okay, well, give it another grade for another reason. I mean, it communicated. Okay, now let me ask you this question. If that theme had been longer, would it have been better?
He may have been more explaining.
Would it have been better with a lot of explaining?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think I remember it because it's two sentences long and I just sat there.
What did you get?
I'm not going to tell you yet.
One thing, I teach in a middle school, and when I grade writing assignments, I get four grades. I get one on content, one on punctuation, one on spelling, and the other one on handwriting. And I can give an A in content and give a B in punctuation.
Okay, well, this was perfectly punctuated. Every word was spelled correctly. So
it's
got three A's so far. Now, content.
Great. Yeah, well, you see, and that's where I'd probably give it an F.
Why?
Well, because it violated, I agree that what the person tried to communicate, they got their point across. But there are certain rules that we have to abide by, or we have a society that would just run rampant with all sorts of habits. If, for example, you don't show up for dinner up here at 5 or 6:15. If you show up at 8 o'clock, should you be able to eat? Well, I suppose you should if you have a good enough reason. But just to sit down at that table up there doesn't mean that somebody has to serve you. And I think that somebody that turns in a paper like that without any type of explanation as to why they've done it, they don't deserve an A. I think even to explain it would be the weakness.
I once tossed out the cliche that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and some student came up and said, you know, if I trade in half the picture for my 500 words. And I said, if you had enough nerve to do it, instead of asking me. No, I mean, now on the other hand, there is a possibility that there's Kevin just coming home from leave at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, geez, what's Tweet going to be a sucker for? You know, I can't think of anything. And it's purely economy, absolutely economy, right?
I did that once on a paper, by the way.
I've done it, and I've gotten away with it.
Yeah, you didn't talk.
Well, I think I did, though. Would you accept as a math teacher someone turning in another problem than the one that was assigned to be done? If you get a certain assignment and they're to do it, then if they didn't do that, it may be wonderful communication, but this was what the assignment was.
What Kevin was telling me was at that moment, with the world in that condition, my kind of new structured rules of assignment were the size point.
And you can agree with him, but you don't have to give him an A.
What do I give him?
What?
I just would say that's unacceptable. I think I appreciated your communication, but this doesn't complete this assignment.
I would have a assignment over, and I would say there the issue is not so much in the intrinsic quality of what you turned in, but in whether it met the assignment or not. And maybe you have to, if you're looking at your ultimate goal as an English teacher, maybe you should reevaluate or restructure your assignment system so you can combine this, having to meet certain needs and still letting the student grow and stuff.
One effect I felt from that assignment was that I did feel that was rather, in real life, you go out and say, I think I'm going to write a comparison contrast paper. First of all, you have a need to write, and then you go out and the form comes later. And most English classes sort of go backwards about it. Now do a narration, now do a this, and then you've got to think of a subject to fit in the narration. And that's what I was doing, and it was wrong, I guess.